Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Grammy-winning engineer Mark Lynette. But first of all, let's talk about a bad tour buy-on. The Raskins, a metal group out of New York, bought on the last Motley Crue tour for $1 million. Now, in case you don't know, whenever you see an opening act at a concert, generally speaking, they're not there because the main act really likes them. It's because the opening act paid a whole bunch of money in order for them to appear. And that's what happened here. Usually what'll happen, though, is, of course, the record label will put up the dough, and there's some sort of camaraderie, unless, of course, the opening act is blowing the main act off the stage, and that goes away pretty quickly. But other than that, usually they like each other, and they have a good time together. In this case, it looked like it was really bad. A lot of bad blood in between everybody. And what ended up happening was the Raskins turned around and sued Motley Crue for $30 million, saying they didn't get their money's worth. Because, among other things, the Motley management decided not to open doors some nights, so the opening act, Raskins, were playing to nobody in the crowd, and then there are other times when the PA was turned off for their PA problems, but that happens all the time with opening acts. It's not a big deal. But probably the greatest indignity was one night when Motley Crue's road crew got soaker squirt guns filled with urine and shot the whole stage up with the Raskins underneath all that. So, of course, they turned around and they sued for $30 million. We'll see how that shakes out. But the fact of the matter is, when you're buying on, make sure that you're buying on to something that you're getting your money's worth. You can't always be sure that's going to happen. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyownercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my new music producer formula course, as well as my other online video courses, at bobbyosinskicourses.com. For more on my music industry and music production blogs, just go to bobbyosinski.com to find the links, where you can also read excerpts from my books. Now, a big blockbuster, Harman was just bought by Samsung. So what's going to happen to all the Harman Audio companies? Don't forget, Harman Audio owns AKG, Crown, Studer, Soundcraft, Martin Audio, BSS, and all sorts of others. Not the least to mention JBL Pro. So this will be interesting to see how this shakes out as well. The reason why this probably happened was because of the connected car. And of course, Harman is really big into car audio and the connected car. Samsung needed that because they're having a lot of problems with their Galaxy 7, which of course has cost them billions of dollars. So they needed to take the heat off somehow. This is the way to do it. But I fear that one of the problems that we'll see is some of these great brands and great companies and great products might go away in the process. The other thing that just happened is Avid is under investigation by a shareholder rights law firm for SEC violations by the execs and board members. And as a result, their stock tanked by 28% yesterday. And that's not a good thing. So we can look at those two big things that are happening in the audio marketplace right now. Just goes to show you that in our little niche, usually public companies don't really fit. My guest today is Mark Lynette, who's worked with Brian Wilson, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Los Lobos, Ricky Lee Jones, and many, many more. Mark has also been the longtime archivist for the Beach Boys and has done a ton of live recording through the years. Mark also has a studio full of very, very cool vintage gear. Plus, he has a mobile truck filled with some of the most high-tech as well. I spoke with Mark from his home in Los Angeles. Let's start at the beginning here. I was reading up on you and found out some interesting things that I didn't know. You started originally in sound reinforcement, right?
Yeah, actually I started in lighting. When I was in high school, I did stage lighting and had my own light show company. This is, you know, the summer of love, you know, 68, 69, somewhere in there. And I had some fun doing it, but not exactly a practical business model, to say the least. Yeah. So around, I guess it would be around 70, 71, I started a PA company with a high school buddy, and we did a fair amount of work. I mean, you know, a lot of college shows, Sha Na Na, Seals and Crofts, Livingston Taylor, Jay Giles. What else did we work with? We did one show with Yes when they were just touring the country for the first time. probably some others that I forgot. Oh, I mean, we did. I remember. That was a light. We did lighting. We do just light. Yeah, our biggest light show, which nobody could see because the spots weren't set properly. But we backed Chicago and Three Dog Night at some big stadium in Forest Hills, Long Island. Anyway, did that for a few years, and you know, one of the problems was that, you know, there was nothing you could buy off the shelf that was really, you know, decent. So I mean, we were using like Altec A7s and building our own Altec A7s and using Altec mixers, and I mean, you know, to be perfectly honest, we really didn't know what the heck we were doing. Had problems with crossovers, and I mean, the irony is that I think we finally got it was after we had decided to throw in the towel, and I think, you know, had like one or two shows left over, and put some new, you know, like I remember we had like a Pioneer electronic crossover we put into service, and that made a huge difference from running passives, but the die was cast.
Yeah.
So we quit, you know, we shuttered that, and I actually moved out here for about, I guess, about a year and a half, found work in several pretty crummy studios, which had the advantage of, you know, allowing me to actually record, you know, and a couple of studios that, you know, if they weren't booked, we all had keys and could do, you know, do demos and record our friends and all that kind of stuff. The disadvantage, of course, was that I didn't, you know, that's not the best way to learn, or it certainly wasn't then, and there wasn't much opportunity.
Yeah.
Because nothing good really was coming through the door. So about the biggest thing I did in that period of time was, I don't remember how I found these guys, but there's a National Lampoon album called The Missing Watergate Tapes. These producers came up with this idea of cutting up Nixon's speeches. To having, you know, so he would admit all the Watergate crimes and so on and so forth. So it's one side of the second or third National Lampoon album, and the other side, interestingly enough, is you know, all the people that went on to be on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
The original incarnation. But anyway, so after about a year and a half of that, I was surviving, so I don't know why, I don't remember why I decided to throw in the towel, but I did. And I went back to New York, and I was living in my folks' place and got a job at a crummy studio in New York City, run by a guy named Ed Chalpin, who you may remember as the guy who signed Jimi Hendrix to a $2 contract and then made, you know, millions off of, you know, repackaging Curtis Knight, Jimi Hendrix albums, and in the settlement, got the Band of Gypsies album. And I gather just recently, I don't know if he's still alive, but somehow the estate made a deal and got all that material for their own. So now they can exploit it.
Wow. I just read somewhere where there's a new Jimi Hendrix album coming out for Black Friday, so maybe that's part of it.
I think the Chalpin stuff's already been out. I was reading something about something they're putting out with Lonnie Young. I don't know. I mean, I the irony is that what would it have been, 8 years later? No. 9, 10 years later, I wound up shepherding the engineering on the Hendrix estate for somewhere around 10 years, 12 years before until the family sued to get it back. I worked for Ed Chalpin for very little money for a summer, and that wasn't going anywhere, and I was commuting into the city, and you know, I couldn't afford to live in the city. So at the insistence of my parents, being of the generation that I am, it was either move out or go back to school. So back to school I went, and I went to Boston University, but was still sniffing around, you know, trying to see if there was any, you know, opportunities in the recording business. And oddly enough, another guy who I met at the time was Joe Ciccarelli, who was a struggling second engineer in the limited market there. And through a very weird set of circumstances, I met somebody who worked at Hanley Sound, which was, well, the, I don't know how big they were at that point, but, you know, they had done the Fillmores and they did Woodstock. And
yeah.
Anyway, so I came home from photography class one day and got a phone call telling me that Frank Zappa was starting a tour that night in Hartford. Hanley Sound had supplied him with the front house engineer, and the guy was deathly ill and was certainly not going to be able, they didn't think, to make the tour. So, you know, call the road manager and see what he says. Well, so I called this guy, Marty Pirellis, the road manager, and I'm sure he would have taken anybody who knew what a microphone was because they were desperate. So I fly down in a little, you know, four engine, you know, prop plane to Hartford. Get to the show just as Mountain has completed their opening act set, and the road manager tells me to go out there and watch the engineer because you're taking over after tonight. Well, in fact, I took over after about 45 minutes. The guy was, I don't know what's wrong with him, but because I never saw him again, but
yeah.
He took off to return. And the interesting thing, of course, is that, I mean, I would have worked for anybody, but I was a huge fan of Zappa's, and I'd seen him once on the previous tour in Boston, you know, where I was living. So the next morning I find myself on the tour bus with, you know, because there was one bus for everybody, with Frank and the band and the road crew and Captain Beefheart, who was on the tour, and we are heading for the Capitol Theater in Passaic, New Jersey, which was a big venue at the time.
Yeah.
And ironically, a venue that my PA company had tried to do a show and done very rather badly about, you know, 2 years before. And I stayed with Frank for a couple of years, or a year and a half, something like that. And Frank was a very smart guy. I mean, he early on bought his own lighting and sound, so he didn't have to rent them. And so that when he was off the road, the stuff could go out with his crew, keep the crew employed, and make money.
Yeah.
So no sooner did we get done with Frank's tour than about 2 months later we took the whole system out with Electric Light Orchestra, came back, did another tour with Frank, and then took it back out with Electric Light Orchestra. This was the, what did we do? We did the El Dorado and Face the Music tours. And sadly, after Frank's second, I forget the timing, but anyway, after one of these tours, Frank let everybody go. He was not happy with the band and, you know, not happy with his management. And so the road manager and I took jobs with Earth, Wind & Fire, and I did a 6 or 8 month tour with them. This is in 1976. And that really broke my will as far as wanting to tour. It was just brutal.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Hockey rinks in Buffalo in February. Yeah, I mean, before the tours before that were great because they were small venues. Well, that's really what it was, small venues. I mean, so they were relatively easy to do and enjoy. And the Earth, Wind & Fire thing was just, you know, huge production. But when I left there, I accepted a job mixing for Journey before they made it. In fact, just as Steve Perry was joining the band.
Right in the beginning. Oh.
Yeah, right at the beginning, yeah. But, I mean, I really didn't want to be on the road anymore. And thanks to my working with Earth, Wind & Fire, I met George Massenburg. And George recommended me for a job at Sunset Sound because they were opening a third studio. And in those days, you actually had, you know, staff, you know, salaried employees, and you needed to have two guys for every room because it was typical, more typical than not, to run two sessions a day, you know, a day session and a night session. So I started working there, I want to say around 77, 78, and was there for a few years. We keep running all this down, but the succinct point, I mean, about being where the action is and how important that is, because it's all about the connections you make, if to be basic about it. I mean, if I hadn't gotten the break with Frank, and I hadn't then left and gone to work with Earth and Fire, I wouldn't have met George. I wouldn't have wound up at Sunset Sound. And somebody I met at Sunset Sound told me about the gig at Amigo Studios, and it just goes, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It just goes on from there, you know. And I'm sure that's still true. It's still true to some extent today. I mean, you know, the whole industry has changed so much. But the lesson that, you know, took me a long time to learn is, you know, you're pretty much better off in most cases, you know, working at a lower job in a very good studio where all the talent, you know, is, than you know, scratching along at some dump, you know. And hoping that someone will come through the door and be a big success and take you with them.
I think I first met you at Amigo. I don't know if you remember. You were...
Vaguely.
Yeah.
It's funny.
You were recording a band called World Citizens that Ted Templeman was producing. And I had produced...
I don't remember that.
You do remember?
No, I don't remember the name of the band at all.
Yeah,
that's unusual.
It might have been something else, and then they changed to World Citizens.
It wasn't Combo Nation or Carrera, was it?
Carrera. That's what it was.
Oh, okay. There you go. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I get those two bands confused. I need to pull out the. I think Carrera issued an album, and I think those were Gene McDaniel's sons.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, that album came out, I haven't heard it in whatever it is, 40, 30 years. I don't think the Combination record ever got finished, although they were quite good. Okay, so that I remember. Just say if I've forgotten the name of the band I worked with,
yeah,
that would give you a little scare.
Well, anyway, that I remember I met you there because, I had produced the demos that got him the deal. And, much to my chagrin, I wasn't allowed to keep going. But again, you know, when you have, Ted Templeman that wants it, so what are you going to do? You know?
No, you all got stories like that. I mean, you know, after I left, after Amigo closed, I was in a production partnership with Steve Berlin, who I met, you know, when I did the Los Lobos records. And, you know, we were trying to find acts and get them signed. And we started working with this songwriter, performer named Pat McLaughlin through somebody we knew at EMI Publishing. And, you know, we did all these demos and all this work. And actually, the irony is that, you know, I went to Lenny Warnaker and he liked the guy and said, here, yeah, you know, here's a budget, you know, go do some work. But he didn't insist on what labels always insisted on, which is, okay, if, you know, we get first dibs, and even if somebody else wants him, we get to sign him for the same, you know, the same price.
Yeah.
And we finally, you know, sort of hit pay dirt, and there were like four different labels interested, but Warner's, you know, didn't have any first dibs, and of course now the guy had a manager who had his own, you know, his own agenda. And so Pat wound up signing to Capitol and was produced by Mitchell Froom. And I will say that out of the decency of his heart, gave me and Steve, I think, $10,000 each out of his advance. And there was a lot of bidding going on for this guy. But we, you know, we didn't get to produce the record.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The record came out and not a whole lot happened. And he made another record, ironically titled Get Out and Stay Out. And the administration at Capitol changed, and they buried the. They didn't put it out.
Yeah, well.
And Pat went on to have some success as a songwriter, but not as an artist. So, yeah, it's one of those things that you you learn. You generally learn the hard way that the Sam Goldwyn statement of a verbal contract isn't worth the paper it's written on.
Yeah, so true, so true. You went out as an independent really early in the game because it was like 1979 or 1980, and there weren't too many indies
at
that
point.
I'm
sorry, say it again?
There weren't too many independent engineers or producers at that point.
Well, no, there were. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, the reason I went independent the first time is that Sunset Sound basically told me, get out. You're doing too much. Doing too much work here. We need second engineers, not guys doing fill-in work. Because in those days, what the studios, recording studios, wanted, well, they wanted the big independents. And I did a lot of work with those guys. I mean, I used to sub for Humberto Gatica all the time. And so I was doing work for him and for a bunch of producers. Sunset decided that they, you know, I could keep working there, but not on their health plan. And that's part of it too, is that, you know, everybody, not just studios, but take advantage of the fact that they'll get put a bunch of employees on the, you know, on the health plan and on the retirement plan, and then when you actually are vested, suddenly they find a reason to let you go.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know if that was part of it, but at that point I was just trying to work. So, you know, I had met some people and I got some work, but it didn't amount to much. And so when I don't even remember how this happened. I mean, I remember who, but somebody told me, you know, a woman that booked, was a contractor, told me that Lee Hirschberg out at Amigo was looking, you know, was looking for a staff engineer. They had lost somebody, and he didn't want to do it all the time. So I went out there and interviewed, and, you know, he put me to work the next week. So, and that was the... That's certainly the best break I ever got. Not only got to, you know, work with people like Los Lobos, you know, before they were, I mean, they were loading their stuff in cardboard boxes, did their first album, and, you know, worked with Randy Newman and Michael McDonald and, you know, all kinds of interesting stuff. And I met my wife there, so not a bad, and I'd have stayed there forever, except unfortunately around 1980, Ricky Lee Jones too, did a lot of work with her. Whose birthday was just yesterday or Tuesday, I think. Unfortunately, you know, in one of the contractions, or for a number of reasons, the label closed the studio around 83, 84, something like that. And that's when I started doing a lot of this, you know, indie work, trying to find bands and get them signed. And yeah, I did a few, you know, had a few things that, you know, kind of got released, and I mean, never really made any serious money. Must have done some other stuff in that time period, but then, you know, the next big change, did I have a manager then? Oh yeah, I think at that point I had a manager and actually got some interesting work through him. And I still got some work from Warner Brothers. They actually kept me on salary for another year, as sort of a severance pay thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the next big break was, you know, not one of those just fortuitous sillinesses where I called Ocean Way, which is, well, now it's back to being United and East West, but I called one day, I guess looking to book time for somebody, for something. And the woman that booked the studio said, oh, by the way, we've got a last minute session on Thursday for Brian Wilson. We need an engineer. You want to do it? And I'm like, sure.
Wow.
And, you know, that, that project went on for a year, and whatever it is, like 28 years, 29 years later, I'm still, you know, associated, to some degree, or more, although now more it's with the Beach Boys archival stuff. I don't really do Brian's records anymore. And I later learned, you know, why that had happened, because a crazy doctor that controlled his life at that point used to, you know, throw him into whatever studio was available at a moment's notice as a form of quote unquote therapy. So when I started working, you know, more or less full time for them, that's what would happen. There would suddenly, you know, be a studio at Ground Control or, you know, wherever, you know, or Sunset or someplace like that. I mean, just out of nowhere. I mean, there wasn't a lot of consistency. It was really pretty nuts.
What was it like working with Brian, Mark? I at this point in time, he had his nervous breakdown. What was his faculties like?
It varied. It's hard to say. I mean, you know, clearly Landy had him medicated And, you know, there were these we called them the surf Nazis that watched him and reported on everything and, you know, kept him away from people and regulated his diet and all that. I mean, you know, he still could create really well, but it was definitely an odd situation to be a part of. And you know, this one, that album went on for better part of a year, but there were some mitigating factors because, you know, Russ Teitelman had a fair amount to do with producing or co-producing the record, and then Lenny Warnker did as well, and then Andy Paley was there as sort of the overall associate producer on behalf of Seymour Stein at Sire, who signed Brian. And but after that record was over, Brian was going to make another record, and this one was going to be just him and the Doctor. And I said, "I'm done."
Yeah.
I mean, I'd been handed the catalog work, and I kept doing that, but I didn't want any part of the solo record. And I didn't come back. Well, actually, I did a lot of work with Andy Paley, who also was not a part of that record. After Brian's album, we did all kinds of stuff. A lot of it for Sire. Actually went all over the world. Went to London several times to record. I mean, these are the good old days when you could do stuff like this.
Yeah, right.
And it's a lot to remember. And then somewhere in that, let's see, what is the timing on it? Oh, yeah, somewhere in that period, I built my own studio out here and did a fair amount of work. I mean, I was doing a lot of remote work. I was doing a lot of punk live records for an outfit called Triple X. I did Jane's Addiction's first album, which was a live album. I did a band called Liquid Jesus for the same label, and they got signed to Universal, and I did that record. You know, it just sort of all tumbles together.
Yeah.
But when Brian got away from the Doctor, the first thing he did was he and Andy came to my studio, and we started recording, and we recorded for the better part of a year, most of which never got released. Some of it has over time. I mean, officially, it's all been bootlegged, of course.
Mm-hmm.
What happened then? What did he do then? I can slowly piece the Brian thing back together, but
yeah.
It's a long road.
Let's go back to live recording, remote recording for a second.
Yeah, because that's mostly what I do now.
Is it really?
Yeah. When things started to peter out, actually, it'd be easy to back into this, actually. I mean, I've been doing live recording forever. When I was working at Warner's, I mean, I actually did a few big projects. I mean, we went out and did a live Arlo Guthrie Pete Seeger album in a bunch of cities. I did a lot of live recording with Ricky Lee Jones. A side career, in a way, because of my work with Ricky. I came to the attention of Lauren Nero, and I worked for her for a few years. And the only thing, we did a lot of recording, but the only thing that ever came out of it that was released was a Live at the Bottom Line album in 1989, somewhere in there. And somewhere in that period, I started buying equipment so I could do remote recording, primarily thanks to John Stevens' portable multi-track recorders. So,
yeah.
You know, we would haul around a 2-inch 16 track, you know, mic preamps, splitters, and all that stuff in the back of my car, and you know, recorded a lot of stuff in bars and venues, you know, around the area. And that's always sort of, you know, it sort of was always a sideline, and you know, moved into digital recording and DA-78s and, you know, so on and so forth as the technology emerged. I had a client named Bill Elliott who funded a big band and did a lot of both album and soundtrack and live recording with him, some with the remote gear. So it always was sort of a sideline. But the majority of my work during that period was a whole series of albums, for a variety of people, but a lot of it with Dave Alvin, both his own solo records. I think the first one we did at my studio, I can't think of the name of it right now. Anyway, won him a Grammy. And he also worked as a producer. So an awful lot of projects, both from him and from Andy Paley, came through my studio. And, really nice projects, but they're all the kind of projects that you can't make anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Unless you want to do them in your garage for $20 an hour and know in advance that no one's going to hear them.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate in a way from a business sense, but I think more from an artistic sense, because there's still albums that, by and large, I think are really, really quite good. There were all kinds, and there were other producers, a guy named Ben Vaughn and Elliot Easton from The Cars, as producers, in some of my own projects, that all just kept running through my studio, and it all started to peter out about, 10, 11 years ago?
Yeah.
Something like that, or maybe a little less than that. The opportunity arose to maybe get into the remote business in a bigger way. FNL, which had been the premier recording outfit, more on the East Coast than elsewhere, but pretty much throughout the country.
Yeah.
They had gotten bought by Sirius XM, and then a few years after that, Sirius XM dropped them. Dropped the division. So some of their ex-employees started a new company called Music Mix Mobile, and they were friends of mine, some of them, because I'd worked with them. And so I proposed creating the West Coast, version of the company.
Yeah.
And with a partner, built this big truck, and we are now in our eighth. Yeah, I guess we're in our eighth year. We just did the CMAs for the eighth time.
I had no idea, Mark. I knew that doing a lot of recording, and I think last time we talked about this, you had basically a fly pack that you were taking around. I remember you were doing something at the Roxy when I talked to you about this, and you described what amounted to a very portable rig, but it wasn't in a truck or anything. So this is the first I've heard about your truck.
Oh yeah, no, I still have the portables because that gets used occasionally too. But no, this is a 42 foot Freightliner with a. We just put in a Lavo M56 this past January. It's all digital, all Matty, all the time, and we can do 192 tracks on redundant on redundant Pro Tools.
Gee, for an analog guy, that's going the opposite way, isn't it?
Well, sort of, but everything winds up there anyway. So it's just a question of when you're going to go there. And while there are a few people out there, basically I think old time artists, one or two that still think it's better to record analog in a remote sense. I mean, it's just crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, not to mention the cost. But I guess you can still do it. But the notion that you're going to run a mic line down 300 feet of copper, that's going to be better fidelity than the way we do it is we convert the preamps are on stage. We convert to digital. There and run it down fiber, and it we don't do we don't do anything to it up front. It all goes flat to the recorders, and then you do whatever you want to do to it in post, or if it's a live mix, for that. But you're not trying to cram it onto 23 tracks or whatever the heck it is. So you can't really ever blind test these things, but I'm frankly always amazed when we pull up, we start to listen to the stage and just how good it always sounds, being a rather pure signal path. I mean, there's so little wire involved.
Yeah, yeah.
It's from the mic to the splitter, to, you know, to our preamps, and from there on, it's all, you know, it's all digital.
Yeah, yeah.
Makes a big difference.
Yeah, definitely.
So that, I mean, that over the past seven, eight years, that's become, you know, the majority or almost the entirety of what I've been doing. And then I also started working out here at the iHeart Radio Theater, which was the audio part of which was kind of designed after the Music Makes Mobile Trucks. We used to run with a Avid control surface, a D control, mm-hmm. as the mixer. So we'd have a third Pro Tool system that was just static. In other words, you just ran it an input or on aux channels or whatever, and then used the surface as your mixer, which is nice. I mean, you know, you put all the plugins you want, and if you're going to remix, you just move the files over, and boom, there you are.
Yeah.
And that's how the trucks operated for the first, whatever it was, 6-7 years. We changed to the Lavo in part because we just, well, the lack of redundancy was a concern. You know, as nice a platform as it is to have all that Pro Tools ability, and also the fact that you can just move it around, you know, oh, okay, I'm done here. Give me my session file, and I'll take the drives and, you know, go to my hotel room and plug it in and keep working. You know, when you're doing big broadcast audio, reliability is way at the top of the list. I always like to joke that, you know, it's television, and as long as there's something coming out of the speakers, you're about halfway there. And the Lavos are, you know, Lavos are totally, I mean, they're real consoles, first of all, but they're also completely redundant. If the core engine failed, it would just switch to the other one. I mean, you basically have two consoles and one control surface.
I thought Avid was doing that with their consoles as well.
No, Avid doesn't have consoles.
They're
Avid
control services.
Services.
Yeah.
As I understand it, they talked for years about making a real broadcast console, but they've never done it. And that was the other, you know, sort of frustration, is that, you know, we couldn't really wait any longer. And the S6 is really not suitable for a mobile environment.
Not at all.
So Lavo just made the most sense. But I was starting to say that I also do an awful lot of work over at the iHeart Radio Theater, which has that older setup where it's a D control as the mixer, and separate recorders. I love the place. I love working there.
Okay, so here's a good question for you. You're thoroughly in the new digital world, and you're very comfortable in that, and you have no problem. But then in your studio, you have an old API console, and you have a UA console, and you know, anyway, you're thoroughly analog there. So, what's
yeah,
it like?
Yeah, but I don't use it. That's the irony. I don't use the analog gear anymore because I'm not really recording anybody.
Yeah.
The record. I'm doing a session. I did something on Sunday, but it wasn't at my studio, and then they're coming in today to edit takes. It was an orchestral piece, so we got to go through and start sorting, you know, which takes to use. But no, I mean, I'm just not recording anybody, for records really anymore. It's just sort of stopped. I mean, I produced a few things over the last few years, you know, that were vanity projects. And unfortunately, I mean, I've got other things to do, and I thought about, well, maybe I'd do some things for fun, but if it's not going to get heard by anybody, I'm not sure what the fun is.
Yeah, sure.
Know?
Yeah, yeah. I'm with you.
I mean, an awful lot of these records that I really enjoyed making, you know, didn't reach a big audience, but they got made, and, you know, somebody heard them. One of the ones I did just celebrated its 20th anniversary with a vinyl reissue, but, you know, the artist is, you know, playing house concerts.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
Well, okay.
Yeah,
I get it.
So I mean, I've got an awful lot of analog gear, and some of it I keep around because I still, you know, have a lot of transfer work and stuff like that for the Beach Boys. But it's pretty much not seeing much use these days.
Okay.
It's sad, but you know, yeah, that's the way it is.
Speaking
but
of,
on the other hand, I can quote Chuck Britt, who was the Beach Boys' main engineer in the '60s, and worked for all kinds of people, but he stopped making records very early in life and wound up just being a tape jockey at the Hanna-Barbera tape transfer room. And I met him a few times when working on the Beach Boys projects, and I asked him about it. I said, "Why'd you stop making records, Chuck?" And he said, "Mark, I couldn't stand all that overdubbing."
Yeah.
So, yeah, I sit there all day and watch somebody, play 1,800 guitar solos, and,
And he's not wrong.
No, absolutely, and it's more the exception than the rule that you do anything else. And I have to say that to some degree, working with live stuff, at least, that's what it is. I mean, there's a lot more we can do to manipulate nowadays than you used to be able to do. And everybody, it's like unusual when you have somebody come and they're not running 14,000 tracks of Pro Tools to augment what they're playing on stage.
Right.
But at least it's a performance,
Yeah.
And I've done a few. I don't get to do that much anymore. But some of this big band work, and I did a cast album in New York a few years ago, and that was probably the best engineering experience I've had in 100 years. It's unfortunate because it was a cast album; it all had to be done in one day. I don't know if you know how that works.
Yeah, I do. Boy, pressure's on, isn't it?
Well, it's financial. The cast gets a week's pay for every day you use them to do a cast album.
Yeah.
So, now, I mean, you can do it because, it also means that you generally use the same musicians that play in the pit. And the cast, obviously, they're doing 8 shows a week, so it's not, it's not too hard for them to bang it out. But you just kind of wish it would go on a little longer.
Yeah, right.
The irony is that the live recordings just sound fantastic, but the guy who was co-producing it, thought it was a pop record and insisted that we spot mic everything, and then he took it and spent 3 months screwing around with it and not only missed the best window of opportunity to release it, but in the end, it didn't sound very good.
Oh, man. That's a drag.
I get that a lot. I mean, people don't understand, and you long for the days when it was about performance more than technology.
Yeah.
The technology is a double-edged sword. I mean, for example, this orchestral thing I just did, we did it at a relatively large studio, but not a huge one. And if it had been a huge, so we had to do it in pieces. You couldn't have everybody play at the same time because, the brass would just blow out everything else. If we had done it, say, on the Newman stage at 20th Century, which is like a football field, you could have set it up like an orchestra, and of course then you'd have to go after performance, but it wouldn't have probably taken any longer, and then it would be done, and it would sound better.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I've done stuff out there, and you kind of find yourself going, "Oh man, I made this sound great," and it's like, "Well, no, you really didn't." I mean,
yeah.
You may be balancing it, but they made it sound great.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, I have to ask you about the Beach Boys and redoing Pet Sounds. You've remixed it twice, right?
I did the first stereo mix. I did a surround mix. I've done it live.
Okay.
Several times. Yeah.
Let me ask you about Good Vibrations. What were the tracks like? How many tracks were there, and what were they like?
Well, I mean, Good Vibrations, it's kind of different from Pet Sounds. I mean, Good Vibrations, the basic tracks were all recorded on 4-track. And, it's all pieces. So unlike Pet Sounds, which was still being performed as songs, the Good Vibrations wound up being done in little sections. And Brian did a lot of experimenting. Try the verse this way, try the chorus this way. And, ultimately cut a backing track together from various places. I mean, the verse the verses are from the first session at Gold Star. The choruses are from a later session at Sunset. I can't sit here and tell you offhand, you know, exactly where they all came from, but you know, it's the first, well, his first instance, probably the first instance, of sort of modular recording where you're not relying solely on a, okay, here's the start of the song, here's the end, play it, you know.
Was it always the same process, players?
What?
Was it always the same players?
Well, if you're talking about the what he was using, the so-called Wrecking Crew, it's all more or less. I mean, but that was true of almost everybody in L.A. I mean, you know, you had the first call guys, and you know, you worked your way down from there. And I don't, looking at the contracts, you don't really see a whole, you know, I mean, you see different people at different times, but it's not like you see, you know, somebody you never saw before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the first call for, you know, well, for Brian, it was always Hal Blaine. I don't think I ever saw anybody else. And any other, well, I'm sorry. Then he started using Jim Gordon, although that was usually in addition to Hal, but not a little later, around late 66, 67. I think Jim Gordon did some of the drumming on his own, mm-hmm. but you know, he was just the next guy in line. So, I mean, the thing I realized rather late was that the reason these guys worked for everybody, and there's another group of them in Detroit, and there's one in, you know, Nashville, mm-hmm. is because that's how you got it done. I mean, you couldn't go in there with a bunch of amateurs and try to find a good bar and cut it together and tune it and replace the bass and all this stuff. No, you had to have, you know, that was your Pro Tools, that was your technology, if you will. The other thing that it took me years to realize was that none of this, you know, oh, you know, give me my own mixer for my headphones. Nobody's got headphones on. They're playing organically, and it sounds nothing like what's coming out of the speakers, but they're still doing just a fantastic job. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the whole thing about, you know, the acoustics of the room, and if you've ever seen Studio 3, where most of the Beach Boys stuff was cut, among other people, or Gold Star, which was a little bigger, but 3 is still there. You can see it in the movie, in Love and Mercy, that's the actual room. It's tiny.
Yeah.
And everybody was piled on top of each other, and you know, obviously couldn't play loud because it would have just bled all over the place. But all that coincident. There's 12, 14 mics. That's all there is. But all that bleed just, you know, made the sound bigger. Mm-hmm. And so a little room like that with good acoustics was actually a benefit, whereas doing it in a big room would have sounded horrible.
Yeah, lots of slap and stuff. Yeah.
The slap would be unusable unless you've got enough of a band. I mean, I've listened to live Sinatra 3 tracks from United A, and you know, that stuff just sounds incredible. Now, and it's just split stereo. You've got the band left and right, and Sinatra in the center. There's no phantom center for the band.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a certain amount of leakage. But you know, if the drums are on the right, if you listen to the left channel, you hear the drums, you know, from across the room. But it still sounds great. So it kind of depended on the sort of music. But to finish up with Good Vibrations, so and this is typical of what Brian had been doing for, you know, forever. You'd get that track, however you got it, as a song or all pieced together, and he mixed that to mono, and he went over it. He started working at CBS. Recording around 65 because they had the only A-track in town. They had a custom-made one-inch A-track that they built using Ampex 354 electronics, stereo electronics. And because of that, you couldn't record on adjacent tracks at the same time because the bias wouldn't hold. So you'd have to record on 1 and 3, 2 and 4, you know.
Yeah.
He'd mix the track down to mono, and then they would do their vocals. They started doing this during the Summer Days, Summer Nights album, California Girls, stuff like that. And about half of Pat Sounds, Wouldn't It Be Nice, Cuddling Those, a few others, were done that way. Which is why stereo mixes, you know, wouldn't have been possible at that time, because all you had was a mono backing track.
Yeah.
So it would have sounded really bizarre. And so when we went to do the stereo mixes on Pet Sounds and all kinds of other Beach Boys stuff in that period, you had to manually sync the backing track, the three or four track backing track, to the 8-track vocal tape, which back when I did it for the first time meant tape machines, and then later, you know, you could do it with DAWs and time slipping and all that. It's a lot easier now.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
And unfortunately, we don't have the 8-track master for Good Vibrations. It was apparently left behind at CBS, although we did ultimately get some of the Beach Boy tapes that had been left there. But for some reason, Good Vibrations, we never got. And the story is that when the studio closed, everything just sat there. And around 10 years later, some genius at CBS decided they wanted the space back and sent somebody over there with a bandsaw and destroyed everything that was still there. Their own product as well. I mean, you know, there was a period of time, you know, in the mid '80s where nobody wanted this stuff. I mean, the attitude, perceived attitude was that this is junk. Yeah. Nobody's going to want to hear this stuff again. We got the mono master, Good Vibrations. So, And what's interesting about the Beach Boys is that they've always controlled their tapes. They were not required to give anything to Capitol except the finished product. And that doesn't mean they didn't lose anything. There are definitely some things that were lost, although not a whole heck of a lot, really. But what it's meant is that an enormous amount of their work in its entirety still exists. I mean, a record label, you know, at most, they wouldn't try very hard, but, you know, they would probably save the final 3-track or 4-track that then was mixed, you know, for the album or the single. But the way recording was done in those days, you know, was you went from 3-track to 3-track, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen some Spectre tapes and, you know, you might go down 5 generations of 3-track, you know.
Wow.
And you'd wind up with, you know, a 5th generation backing track, a track of all the vocals combined and all the strings combined, and that's it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So because Beach Boys have always controlled their tapes, we have, you know, virtually everything. I mean, when we came to do Pet Sounds, it was wonderful because we had 99% that were missing one tracking date. But the labels would throw all that stuff away. And
yeah. Ken Scott told me a story about a Beatles, George Harrison tape. And apparently what happened was Trident Studios went through new ownership. And somebody was looking at the pile of debris in the background, out in the back, and found all these multi-track tapes. And one happened to be My Sweet Lord from George Harrison. So the person called up and said, hey, I think you might want this. And there were Elton John tapes and whatever that were just being thrown out.
Oh, yeah, they're legends. I mean, yeah. Bones Howe will tell you how when radio, you know, Radio Recorders out here was one of the, first independent studio out here.
Yeah.
And everybody recorded there, including the Beach Boys, to some, well, a little bit. Help Me Rhonda was cut there. But Elvis recorded there. And when the place went out of business, they just tossed all the tapes in the alley. I mean, you know, tons of jazz. Also. And Bones tells me that he went down there, and there were all these Elvis masters. And you know, RCA didn't want them. He took them home and ultimately sold them back to RCA. Years later. But there are tons of stories like this. When Gold Star closed, I've had Dave Gold tell me this, around 82, something like that, they called everybody up, come get your tapes, and they said they got very little response, so they took everything that was still there and put it in storage. And he said that after a few years, he and Stan Ross, his partner, decided A, they didn't want to pay for it, and B, they didn't want the responsibility, went down to the storage unit, pulled all the flanges off into the dumpster. And you can only imagine what must have been there.
Yeah.
Being that, you know, Gold Star was the premier independent studio, or one of them in those days.
Yeah, yeah.
The irony is that Gold Star used to run a demo service. You know, I record your, you know, Tuesday evenings from 5 to 8, you could book time, and they had a band there. You come with your poem or, you know, whatever, and they would make a record. Yeah, they would record your song. Now, nobody owned those tapes, so those tapes they gave to a local mastering guy, and they still exist. Can't do anything with them, but they still exist.
Yeah. Wow.
I mean, I've seen this, you know, Bell Sound in New York, apparently when they closed, just everything went in the dumpster. And a lot of it, you know, people knew about it, so a lot of stuff got, you know, got retrieved. But, it, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Legendary stories that, you know. Yeah.
Last question, because I know you're busy. I don't want to keep you too much longer here. In your travels throughout your career, did you ever receive one piece of advice that really made a difference to you? Or maybe did you learn something along the way that was that really was kind of like a mantra for you?
First thing that comes to mind is something that, remember Ted Templeman saying to me, you can never have too much bass. Oh, God, I can't think of anything right offhand.
Okay.
More coming to my own, you know, my own revelation. I mean, kind of going back to what I said about, you know, getting any job in the best place with the most opportunities. If you're trying to get somewhere in this business. But, you know, one thing we haven't touched on is, and I don't know how this relates to anybody these days, but, you know, why I wanted to do this. I mean, you know, fortunate enough to have grown up with the biggest boom in pop music. I mean, you know, I was 12 when the Beatles came to America. So, you know, my experience from a very young age was listening to pop music on the radio and just, you know, marveling at, you know, it was like this stuff was coming from Mars. And being somewhat of a techno junkie, you know, my father had a tape recorder that I played with and all this stuff and, you know, recorded my records. I was just fascinated with how could this stuff possibly, I mean, I knew it was made, but how, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I would have given my right arm to just stand in a studio and watch, you know, one of these records being created. And, you know, that has an enormous overriding reason why I got into this. It's a little hard to imagine that you know, if that's the way somebody feels today, but maybe, you know, maybe so. But it just, you know, growing up, the music just meant so much culturally and everything else, you know, in my life and everybody I knew's, you know, lives, not my parents, of course, but, you know, everybody of my generation. It was just so inspiring.
Yeah.
And I still feel that way when I, you know, put up a Beach Boy tape or, you know, or get my hands on somebody else's masters from, you know, from that period. You just hear, you know, how these things, how different it was the way these things were created. You know, not that what we do now isn't valuable, but I mean, just the musicianship and the technique. I want to say it almost doesn't have any relation to the way music is created nowadays. I mean, certainly doesn't to an awful lot of music that's created, you know, completely synthetically. But even music that's played, and I think to a large extent, maybe suffers from that. I mean, the musicianship and the creativity. I mean, when you listen to somebody like Brian, you know, taking these musicians and with their help honing into what, you know, becomes the basic track for God Only Knows, which, you know, was cut in four or five hours. And, you know, when he walked away, that was it. I mean, there was never another, you know, anything but vocals added to it.
That's awesome.
Know, nowadays, we'd probably spend most of that time getting a drum sound.
To find out more about Mark's mobile truck, you can go to musicmixmobile.com. That's all one word, musicmixmobile.
Thanks for listening and being my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyosinski.com or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyosinski.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.